This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Daly. Our guest this week is Greg Dowd, President and CEO of the National Milk Producers Federation. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. America's sweetest industry creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food product ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with NMPF's Greg Dowd next. America's 11,000 sugar beet and sugarcane farmers count on a strong U.S. sugar policy to keep American consumers supplied with an essential ingredient. Better yet, it's designed to cost taxpayers nothing. These farmers support more than 151,000 jobs throughout the sugar supply chain in both urban and rural communities. They contribute over $23 billion to the economy each year and help keep it sweet in America. Learn how the Farm Bill supports sugar crop farmers and workers at sugaralliance.org. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Dairy farmers in the industry that brings milk and dairy products to our tables across America and around the world has certainly been under siege over the past several years. NMPF President and CEO Greg Dowd says many areas of the industry are looking up and there is hope for expansion domestically and to global markets. While H5N1 has drawn plenty of headlines, Dowd says the bottom line message is that FDA testing proves milk and dairy products are safe for consumers.
Pasteurization, the tests have been run, the analysis has been done. We've been using pasteurization in milk for over 100 years, and the results are this takes care of the issue of milk safety for U.S. consumers. Pasteurization renders all of this material dead or interactive or inactive or however you want to put it with regard to the safety of milk and consumers. But there are a couple of other issues. With you're speaking of H5N1 here, Jeff. There are a couple of other issues that we need to get into here that are going to be a challenge for the dairy industry, I think, or at least one of them for some time. But as far as the milk safety side of the equation, we're in great shape there.
So are we testing enough? Is there enough of a sample rate of testing that we still, again, have confidence that pasteurization is doing its job?
Yeah, FDA has done those tests. It takes a scientific calculation and formulation in terms of understanding how many samples you have to take. It takes a special lab. It takes a level 3 lab in which you take the samples and use an egg yolk formula, and that's a lab in Georgia that does that. And so these are not tests or process that you can do in a high school chemistry lab. This has to be done in a level 3 lab to get it right, and the answer is FDA has conducted that. We're very sure now on the issues of pasteurization, but there's going to be a lot of testing done in terms of prevalence, in terms of where the virus is relative to the dairy cattle herd in the United States. A lot of questions about how this thing is moving and where it has moved through and where we think maybe it has yet to move through. So many things we don't know yet about this virus, and we're going to be having that conversation, I think, for quite some time into the future.
So aside from migratory birds, what measures either are in place or need to be stepped up to keep this disease from spreading?
Well, it's a virus, so you're not going to keep it from spreading. Let's be clear about that. And so in addition to migratory birds, one of the other vectors, if you will, or potential vectors that we have to better understand is wildlife. USDA has been looking at this wildlife service for years. We have found H5N1 in a number of different wildlife, versus seals, even a polar bear, foxes, skunks, all kinds of different mammals, and understanding how this virus is moving, from wild birds into mammals, or even potentially from dairy cows back into poultry, there is a great deal yet to be learned about all of this. And in addition, then, We now have three cases where humans have had conjunctivitis, pink eye, and understanding, that transmission and what that means on the human side of the equation. A great deal of work that has to be done here yet. But we've migrated on this issue in just the last six. We only started this March 25. Which was the first instance that we know of in the world where we've had this in cattle and dairy cattle. So we've looked at the milk. We're trying to understand now, in a dairy cow, when is she transmissible? When does she shed virus? For how long does she shed virus? What are the issues with regard to people? Many things, Jeff, that we just don't know. That we're going to have to look at and study for a long time. You noticed here recently that USDA has said that we're going to use about $824 million in CCC money to do what we can to wrap our head around this. The point being is that this is has the potential to be an upper respiratory virus in mammals, and for that reason. There needs to be a lot of understanding of the future of this virus and its ability to mutate, et cetera. We're always worried about viruses mutating. This is nothing new. It's just a matter of understanding as best we can, and this is a whole new ballgame.
How about personal protective equipment and other means to keep the disease from spreading from infected animals to those who work with the animals?
So that is something that the National Milk Producers Federation has been very active on here, working with our member co-ops and working with producers and understanding that in terms of gloves and protective eyewear with workers is something we've got to do. The other thing that we have to do that we, through our farm program, which is our animal welfare side of the equation, we had and worked for years on preparing for things like foot and mouth disease. And what has been just really fortunate is that we've been able to take that work that we had in terms of biosecurity for foot and mouth disease and use it for this. And so we had the protocols in place. We had the protocols in Spanish. We had the books on the shelf ready to go, crank them out to our members and say, hey, look, just adjust this a little bit and this is going to work well. Biosecurity now on farm is absolutely paramount. And it isn't paramount for the dairy producer in terms of the milk production or any economically for him at the dairy farm, but where it does apply, Jeff, is that if you are a dairy farm in proximity to a poultry or turkey farm or egg-laying farm, you must enhance your biosecurity. And what I'm talking about here is the days are over when you can have that feed truck or that fuel truck go to your dairy farm first and then stop by at the poultry farm on its way back. That cannot happen. In this day and age of dealing with the high path avian influenza H5N1 now in dairy cows. And so there has to be a conversation in farm country, and in particular those areas, we have instances in Michigan and Iowa where we have poultry farms and dairy farms in close proximity. This is really sensitive now for the poultry folks, and we understand that in the dairy industry.
So what have we learned about the disease spread, especially from the birds to mammals, and then perhaps if there has been or if could be mammal to mammal?
What USDA APHIS is telling us, Jeff, is that they believe it was a one-time deal in Texas last winter, they think maybe December or last fall, that this thing jumped from wild birds into a dairy cow. They're not sure that, based upon their analysis of the strain of the virus, et cetera, that strain seems to be consistent throughout all of this. And so how do we think we have spread this from dairy cow to dairy cow has not been through the air or nose to nose contact as much as it has been mechanically. And so what we're doing in the dairy industry today by purely efficiency means, and it's something that works really well in the dairy industry, is we're raising thousands and thousands of replacement dairy heifers in Texas and in southwest Kansas. They have their first calf, they start milking, and then they're moved to their permanent location. And so when you have a cow, the great challenge here is so many of these cows don't have any symptoms that you can see. They're asymptomatic. And so you have a cow that you think is fine, or at least early on, and you moved her and hooked her up to the new milking machine, and all of a sudden you've infected other cows. Now, what's interesting about this to kind of walk you through is typically only about 10% of the cow herd shows symptoms. And typically it's older cows, later in lactation, they'll go down for 7 or 14 days and go off feed and quit milking. What we're seeing is within about 45 days, the vast, vast majority of them are back up and running again and doing fine. In some cases, they don't come back, and in just a handful of cases, we've lost some cows, but typically those cows had a lot of other things going on other than just this. And so it hasn't been a hugely significant issue for us economically in the dairy industry, because we have, keep in mind, too, we have about 26,000 dairy farms in the United States. Thus far, as of right now, I think we're just maybe at about 90 farms where we've tested positive for this virus.
Has this had an impact or moved the needle at all on domestic consumption or your ability to export product?
It's a great question, and thus far the data from the Dairy Checkoff folks seems to be that consumption is up by just a tenth or two or three of a percentage point. So the answer to your question is no.
So now let's think about the dairy industry overall. You certainly have been through some rough times for dairy producers, and the industry has gone through a number of changes. If you were testifying before a particular subcommittee or committee in Washington, what would you say is the state of the industry now, and what are your greatest needs?
Well, the state of the industry right now is we've seen a really nice uptick in prices, Jeff. And in fact, I would go so far as to say that the vast majority of producers today are above their cost of production in terms of what they're getting back out of their milk check. This is a vastly improved situation from where we were last fall, and in particular about September of last year, where it was just downright ugly. We were in the red, and it was not certain for how long. You know, one of the things that has helped has been the value of these calves this spring, especially if you're beef on dairy. That's been a nice piece of income relative to history because of what we have going on in the cattle business right now. But things have turned around here pretty well. The other good news is that we have, really solid USDA risk management programs in place here that have worked well throughout this process. They haven't, I don't know that we can say they're a huge thing, but they've certainly been helpful. They've certainly worked as they were intended here last fall, and now we're out of that situation. We're our cost of production and prices are above the threshold, so we haven't kicked in on those here in the last couple of months, but the answer is we seem to be over the top of the hill here and on the back slide, hopefully.
June is Dairy Month. How important is that to the dairy industry, and what do you hope to impress upon not only your fellow members of the agriculture community, but consumers?
The answer is, in Dairy Month, we're talking about the optimism in this industry. We have, $6, $7, $8 billion in new processing coming online. There is an enormous amount of new investment in the dairy industry nationwide. We are exporting now somewhere in the vicinity of 18% of our production. This new capacity that we have coming online is going to allow us, I think, in particular on the cheese side of the equation, to enhance that going forward. We've got to be competitive on price with the Europeans, especially into Asia going forward. And overall, however, I think there's enormous optimism about the future of the dairy industry and the new investment, the new products, the new innovation, new technology that we have is, I think, pretty extraordinary and unique to other sectors and commodities in agriculture right now.
Would you say the opportunity is equal for large and small producers, or is there still a squeeze on the medium and smaller operations?
Well, I think the answer to that is, first of all, yes, there's equal opportunity for all size operations. You know, we have robotics on farm now, and that allows a unique situation with regard to cost of production for smaller operations that put you on par and competitive with larger operations. But I think that's the issue, is that if we're going to be competitive in this in producing milk on farm into the future, we have to be mindful of continuing to invest in innovation and technology to be, in the best ability that we can to be the low-cost producer. And that's not unique to anywhere else in agriculture either, is it? Everybody in agriculture has to continue to work on that and innovate. And I think we have the technology in the dairy industry now that more than ever allows folks with different business models and different sizes to be competitive from a cost standpoint using this technology.
So you've got two factors that are important for price discovery for dairy. One of those is the federal milk marketing order, and the other is the farm bill. How do these two work in tandem to help to set the structure for your future?
There is a big date coming here in terms of the federal milk marketing order reform effort that's been going on for quite some time. Been painful, in fact, and how long it's been going on. But on or about July 1, we're going to have the rule coming out, or the report coming out of USDA on what their proposal is, or at least their tentative proposal is going to be, and have an ability to react to that. We're all now, within a couple weeks of that, waiting to see what that's going to look like and have an ability to react to that. That's going to be a very important step in the process here. And so, we'll have, I think, in about 60 days to respond, and then USDA will come out and provide final comments here. And then late this year or early next year, producer members in these regional orders will have the ability on a regional basis to vote on them up or down, and we'll be able to move forward here. So there's been an enormous amount of effort in looking at how to revise all of this, and I think the National Milk Producers Federation is, we were unanimous in what our recommendations were. We're pretty comfortable at this point in the process, and then we'll just have to see what USDA comes out with. We're also comfortable on the farm bill side of the equation. You know, it was back in 2014 that we started with the risk management side of this conversation. We had to make big changes in 2018. This time around in the farm bill, I think we kind of like where we are. We're pretty well dialed in with all this. No real major changes. We've got to kind of update some data here. So that's the good news, is that in terms of the farm bill side of this conversation, we're probably in as good a shape as we ever have been in that topic when it comes to a farm bill.
You've seen detail of the House plan approved through the committee, and you've seen some generalities from the Senate, but there's no specific language as yet. Whether you're listening to either side of the aisle, is the message generally acceptable for the dairy farmer?
Yeah, on the House bill, it's just right where we want it to be, right down the middle of the plate. So we couldn't be happier with what Chairman Thompson has come up with in terms of dairy on the House side of the equation. Obviously, we've been working with both the House and Senate for years on what we'd like to see, and I think we're in really good shape there. Really happy. The issue is, we got to get the process going here and get this thing done, because it isn't going to get any easier next year. That's for darn sure.
So that takes us to the next question. What happens if there is another extension? What policy will you be left with given the financial circumstances you're operating under?
Well, I think that's the issue is on the higher of, the class 3 and 4 and how all that works. We've got dueling processes here with USDA's reform of the federal milk marketing orders and then the farm bill process in Congress, and so this, both of these know that this is a priority, and it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds over time. But really, overall, I think, not as much for dairy as it is U.S. agriculture in general. People have to understand that if we have to wait for a new CBO score, a new process here in terms of what the baseline is for agriculture, it isn't going to get any better for us. Overall in agriculture, it's going to get worse, folks. we got to get this thing done. You got to make hay while the sun is shining here, and there'll be clouds here at some point. This won't be pretty.
Greg, what efforts towards sustainability have been made by dairy farmers? More specifically, what's the impact of now approved feed ingredients on your ability to head toward net zero?
Excellent question. And the dairy industry is really at the tip of the spear on these sustainability issues, you know, the methane issues, the carbon issues. We have several hundred methane digesters in the dairy industry in the United States now. Enormous amount of work on the energy side of the equation and carbon and sustainability side of the equation has been done in the dairy industry through our farm ES program, and we have some great folks in the industry working on that. Going forward, I think the question is in terms of what is government policy going to be in terms of the tax code and tax policy. We know we've got Bovaer, the brand newly approved feed additive here. The question for that is we go from the laboratory side of the equation to the commercial side of the equation. Obviously, the economics of this and the fact that I think it's going to work. It's just a matter of how well it's going to work and what we can do in terms of the cost to expand the use of it and make it something that we're using across the industry, because I think it's going to really help us. So I'm excited to see, you know, as the thing gets up and running and evolving here from an economic standpoint, just how much it's going to help.
I think about moving forward, and obviously the dairy digester has proved that it can have a significant impact on sustainability, but also think about, the small and the medium-sized operation, whereas nutritionally that may have some opportunity for them, or genetics may have some opportunity for them. But if there are blanket statements for industry to move ahead, that may further favor the larger over the smaller.
Well, a couple points that I would make on that is, from an old cattle guy perspective, Jeff, you know that, about half of what we do is genetic and about half of what we do is environmental. So, you know, things go hand in hand in that area. But with the digester, what really the innovation is that if you can get a group of dairies that go together and put a digester in a central location where everybody feeds into that digester in a central location, it doesn't really matter what size you are. Everybody can benefit from that. And I think that's one of the really interesting things that folks are working on, depending on what area of the country you're in.
You're talking about cooperatives working together. Can you explain this initiative and what do you hope it means in terms of customers outside the U.S.?
Well, that is a program that is really unique in all of U.S. agriculture, where it's a self-help program that the cooperatives self-fund an initiative to enhance their opportunities in export markets. We dial it in a very specific way and look at it to try to figure out a way in a non-competitive basis that benefits the entire industry. How we can enhance export opportunities. And from my background as an economist and an old trade guy for a long time, Jeff, as you know, there has here in the last, I've been here now about 6 months on this job, there has been a lot of just really heavy-duty number crunch and spreadsheet work analysis and looking at ways to better utilize this program going forward. And really, really have to emphasize how unique and for lack of a better word, Jeff, it's a really cool thing. it really works. It's been, I think, something that's really helped us on the cheese side of the equation, and I would argue has created a little bit of a short squeeze here for us this spring. It's been helpful.
Well, Greg Dowd, to be such a young man, you have an extensive career in serving agriculture at so many different levels. We thank you for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic and congratulate you now by working with the nation's milk producers. This is Open Mic, Greg, and today you've got the last word.
Jeff, it's an honor and privilege to work for farmers. I'm a Kansas farm boy that has now been in Washington over 30 years, which means of absolutely no value to anyone in the outside world, and just happy to be a part of really, really growing and exciting industry.
Our thanks to Greg Dowd, President and CEO of the National Milk Producers Federation, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. America's sweetest industry creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. For AgriPulse, I'm Chap Nellie.